Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting on location and out in the country. So there might be an opportunity today for the storm that I'm now in to cause a little outage. If you go hear music, we'll be back in a few minutes. We won't have the regular connection, but hopefully you'll be able to hear it, and we have a lot to share today. I'm going to talk about zinc, this little-known mineral. I mentioned it yesterday, even more today, and why we really should eat our broccoli. We have some new research today to share with you from a major study at a longevity and aging center. And then we're going to talk about how eating the right food can reduce the risk of high blood pressure. Duke University Medical Center. I'm going to talk about new evidence on how green tea and apples could protect your health. And that's from Norwich Bioscience Institute. And we're also going to talk about how pears could be a part of a healthy diet to manage diabetes. North Dakota State University, and a lot more on health and healing. Then I promised I would start doing more. I do them not that frequently, but occasionally when I find that something's happening in the larger social discourse that misrepresents, under or overstates historical fact, I like to offer a little different perspective. And if you find value in what I am sharing, good. If not, it's okay. I'm going to talk about the Crusades today because I believe that if we could pull back from constantly overreacting to news of terrorist events, domestic or international, and look at the progenitor, where did all this originate? And then if you ask the average person about what's their perception of the level of civilization, of culture, of ethics, of literature and science, back when the Crusades were happening, almost universally in this country, you'll have the idea that we were engaged in manifest destiny. Well, I talked about manifest destiny on a recent show last week and how that led to Thomas Jefferson, who was the real promoter of the Western movement based upon the 1803 treaty that gave the Louisiana Purchase, which originally was just going to be the port of New Orleans, but then it was negotiated for $15 million, the entire land area going clear out from the Mississippi, clear out the Rocky Mountains. That's a lot of states. But no one had gone out there. No one knew what was out there. But he knew there was great economic opportunity. There was. But how do you manage to destroy entire villages, communities, the culture that these people have been living with for a long time without any regret or remorse or empathy? And yet of 70 tribes in just one stretch of about 1,500 miles, there was not a single hostile tribe amongst those 70. Why didn't we ever hear about the peacefulness, the openness, the genteelness of these wonderful Native Americans? Why were they portrayed with such almost demonic characterization? It is that same mindset that allowed us to engage in the Crusades with no empathy for the people we were destroying. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history on that and tie it into what's happening today. But we always like to start with the latest on something that can impact all of us, and that is the choices we make when it comes to our diet. And I'm sure many of you realize maybe you could have done it better. Well, it's not always that complicated. For example, Oregon State University found by just adding zinc, this simple mineral, you could actually reduce chronic inflammation. Now, we're not talking about a lot of zinc. 15 milligrams, that's a small amount. But as according to the article published in Molecular Nutrition and Food Research, that mineral zinc directly impacts our immune system, and that in turn makes it involved in our cardiovascular condition and cancer. So there are multiple things that happen when you have inflammation in the body. And one of the first things that happen is you have a reaction in the white blood cells, and those are monocytes. And zinc, if you're deficient in it, actually increases the interleukin 6 gene expression and inflammation. But when you have enough zinc, you can tamp down that. In effect, you turn off the inflammation. Well, think of multiple sclerosis, think of heart disease, think of diabetes, think of cancer, think of Alzheimer's. All of those have something in common. Underlying the biochemistry in the cell is inflammatory oxidative stress. So this one nutrient can make a difference. Also, according to a study, the world's longest-lived rodents have a unique biochemistry. And they found that giving them steamed broccoli enhanced their overall longevity. This is at the Barshot Institute for Longevity and Aging at the Health Science Center. And so broccoli was very important. But they're suggesting here that heating the broccoli, like in steaming it or stir-frying it, actually allows a greater utilization of its nutrients. And this was also presented at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So the takeaway message is simple. We need broccoli. We need broccoli sprouts. Broccoli is not eaten by most Americans, but it should be. You can stir fry it if you really want to make it tasty. Steam it for about 3 minutes so it's not hard crunchy. It's mildly crunchy. Then saute it with coconut oil and shallots, shiitake mushrooms, and garlic. And then that's a delicious little side dish. Or you could stir that into a baked potato. Or you can stir it into brown rice or quinoa. It makes a big difference. Duke University Medical Center published in the American Journal of Hypertension. This was the first study ever that showed a direct link between eating meals away from home and high blood pressure. High blood pressure is also known as hypertension, and it's the main risk factor for cardiovascular disease. In hypertension, it's a silent killer. You don't know you have it. And what happens is there's a greater force of blood pushing up against the walls of the blood vessels, and the harder the heart has to pump, which can lead to heart failure or heart attack. So people with high blood pressure or hypertension are also at an increased risk for kidney failure, aneurysms, and stroke. How big a problem is it? 2 million children in the United States, 70 million adults, 70 million. Wow, that's about one-fifth the entire population suffer from hypertension. Why? Because we eat so much of our food outside of our home, and these are just high in empty calories, saturated fat, and salt. And these are the eating behaviors that are linked to high blood pressure. So this is a study that found that 27% of all students had pre-hypertension. 49% of male participants and 9% of female participants had pre-hypertension. And they found that 38% of students ate more than 12 meals a week. That's 2 meals a day away from home. Now, there's two movements going on right now in the United States, and we didn't originate them. They originated in Europe. One was slow food, the whole idea that you should take your time in preparing food and eating it, turning off the television and the telephones, and just putting on some nice music and If you had the opportunity to enjoy a meal with a friend or partner or family member, great. But if not, still give yourself that same ambiance. And then the other is that when you're out selecting food, take that extra effort. Go to the farmer's market. Get out and see the freshest locally grown produce. Now, everything doesn't have to be certified organic. In fact, in many cases, that's not an accurate way of understanding the health of food. What you want to do is speak with the farmer. Do you use sprays? Now, a person could say, yes. What do you spray? Well, I spray garlic and ginger. And that keeps certain worms and aphids and away from my plants, insects away. Or our inner plant nasturtiums and pansies. And that also keeps insects away. Or a plant around the border of my garden, I'll plant garlic and onions and shallots. And that also keeps, and scallions, that keeps away certain plants well. So the fact that someone sprays, ask them more. So you see what they spray. Now, if they're spraying any pesticide that's not natural, then you can say, okay, but I'm not going to have that. Don't want that in my body. Understandable. Because for every farmer that you meet that says, well, I spray something toxic, you're going to meet two that says, no, this is all natural. And they don't have to be certified. Look, I had the first teaching farm in New York State, teaching organic farming, the Fertilert Farm. And thousands upon thousands of people over the years came and learned how to farm. At my home, my ranch down in Florida, I also had a certified organic farm. And again, I never grew anything to sell. I grew things to show people what could grow, how to grow things. Even in the summer, even in Florida where no one grows stuff, I was growing everything because learning how to enrich the soil. Even right now, as of today, I have only one tree remaining and trying to figure out the engineering to get it back up because it weighs over 10,000 pounds. It's one tree. It's huge. It's a 55-foot tree, Bismarck. But over 37 other trees, not one was cut. They were all put back in the holes, rebedded with new soil, fertilized, staked, and are alive. And I'm anticipating full recovery over the next 3 to 6 months of all of them. I didn't see another person driving up and down the streets who's willing to do this. I'm sure many would have if they knew it was possible that a tree that's completely out of a hole, you put it back in. How do you do that? Well, there's a machine. It's called a bobcat. And you can get a boom on it, meaning a long arm that goes up. And then you get a 10,000 weight-resistant strap that goes around. So at the top, you're holding the tree. At the bottom, you've got this bobcat that weighs 10,000 pounds. And most trees are between 3 to 7,000 pounds. You pull it up. You dig out the hole. You put topsoil, about 3 feet of topsoil, quality soil in it. You put bat manure in there, you put it back in there, you stake it, and all around, so the tree has no chance to fall over, 6 to 8 stakes, and you water it every day. So you save it. If you didn't have the background in organic farming or forestry, agriculture, you might not know those things. But we have had millions upon millions of Americans who knew all this, who knew how to preserve food, how to dry food, how to last through winters, and they were healthy. And then other people didn't have any of these skills, and they sacrificed their health, frequently dying from the environment. So it's all about what we need to know. Well, you don't have to have a state inspection that costs you $5,000, where a person comes and looks around, takes a sample of your soil, and checks to see what you're growing, how much you're growing, how often you're growing it, and then gives you a certification. You don't need a certification in order to grow things organically and to go to farmer's market. You just put a sign up and says, this produce was grown without any artificial sprays or fertilizers, or nitrogen-based fertilizer as well. And then people know, okay, fine, buy it. Anyhow, we need more organic food in our diet. And according to the latest study, green tea and apples could be really important for us. Dietary studies have shown that people who eat the largest amounts of fruits and vegetables have the greatest reduced risk of developing chronic conditions, such as heart disease and cancer. And there are several reasons for this. Some fruit and vegetable naturally contain high amounts of compounds called poly, P-O-L-Y, phenols, P-H-E-N-O-L-S, which could provide protection and health benefits. In a particular study, they showed that polyphenols in green tea and apples block a signaling molecule called VEGF, which in the body can trigger atherosclerosis and also cause cancer. So in the body, VEGF is a main driver of blood vessel formation in these new cells via a process called, and I've mentioned this many times, angiogenesis. Angiogenesis is crucial in cancer progression, meaning the cancer has to be fed. So the cancer grows vessels, blood vessels, that supply it with blood. And this is also true in atherosclerotic plaque and plaque ruptures. And rupturing plaque is a major cause of heart attack and stroke. And so using this knowledge, they found that the polyphenols in apples and green tea interfere in this whole process. So therefore, the cancer doesn't get the blood and you don't get this inflammation and the destruction of your arteries. To the contrary, the more apples you eat, the more green tea you drink, the healthier your arteries, your epithelium, the lining of the arteries, your heart, your blood pressure, and also it stimulates nitric oxide, and that's important too. So, and pears could be a part of a healthy diet to manage diabetes. This is according to North Dakota State University. And we've heard, of course, an apple a day. That's popular. One new study suggests that pears, as a part of a healthy diet, could play a role in helping to manage type 2 diabetes and diabetes-induced hypertension. And the results were published in Food Research International. And also, it found that pears can help against the bacteria Helicobacter pylori, which plays a role in intestinal ulcers. I would suggest, of course, I consider the best of all pears is the Comus pear, and because it's sweet and juicy. It's not mealy or pulpy like a lot of pears are. But you can always juice pears. That's another nice way of getting them into your body. And then, finally, blueberries. This study from Asian News International, done from Louisiana State University, shows that blueberries can help treat post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't know that. That's brand new information. And I'm always interested, how? Well, it seems as if it demonstrated that the selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting increases levels of serotonin 5-HT and the neurotransmitter norepinephrine, and that the increase might reduce the effectiveness of the therapy. So what they did, they tried different experiments. They found that blueberries modulate neurotransmitter levels all by themselves. So forget the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, just blueberries. Blueberries can help post-traumatic stress disorder, as can L-taurine, and as can L-lysine, and 5-hydroxytryptophan, and magnesium, and neuromagnesium. So, a lot of good things that we could put in our body instead of a toxic drug. Tomorrow I'll deal with pomegranate. Can a pomegranate a day keep a heart attack away? and selenium. How much do you take to reduce heart damage following a cardiac arrest? And tango dancing does what? Something interesting from McGill University. And a pomegranate and dates keep the doctor away in a different way, and I'll share all that. So we have a lot coming up tomorrow. That's our health nutrition segment. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We like to take on the issues that can give us a moment to pause, something to think about, try to get a different perspective on things. Too often we are in contempt of patients and having an opportunity to share quality time looking at something from a perspective we might not otherwise pay attention to. Well, that's what we do here. We give ourselves that time. And I do what's called a classroom on the air, meaning I'll take an issue. I don't worry about how much time I spend on it. I just want to look at it and see if there's something in what we're looking at and discussing that can help us broaden our perspective. And I think that's important. For example, there was a time when Galileo was censored, so much so that he ended up censoring himself. But he was right. Do you remember what Galileo said that everyone found so offensive? Think for a moment. Galileo said what? And what did the church do because he said it? So just think for a moment, and you realize, from Galileo and before and on till today, you could have the right information, sharing that information, improving it, and you could be attacked for sharing honest, accurate information. That's how far we've come. And I'm concerned that we shouldn't be a society that fears the truth. So when we hear about shooters in the United States, why is it that we will look at the gun issue, which should be looked at, that's legitimate, but we don't look at, is there any other mitigating factor that could contribute to this person doing such a heinous thing? And so we went back and we looked over the last 30 years at all the individuals that had killed individuals, mass killings, not just one person. And we found that over 95% of these people all had something in common. They all were on psychiatric medications of different types. And some of them were on multiple psychiatric medications. Well, we happened to have gone out to Colorado and we interviewed all the people we could on Columbine. And all of them had something to say. They said that they were very disappointed that what was presented about them in the Moving Bullet of Columbine wasn't what they really felt. They felt that they had been misrepresented. It was the drugs that the teenagers were on that caused this to happen, because before they were on the drugs, they were normal kids. That's what everyone said. They were normal until they got on the drugs. Well, why wasn't the media willing to discuss this? So I did the drugging of our children. And in there we showed the impact of what a drug can do. It can change a normal behavior into an antisocial one, being so extreme, it can cause delusions, paranoia, great hostility where you want to kill someone or yourself. And yet, not once has anyone in the mainstream media taken the time to look to see what role could the drugs have played. Now, we have that same phenomenon of denying the truth and self-censorship when it came to the subject of suicide. We have more American soldiers who've died from their own hand than all of the Americans who died in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Now, that's a terrible legacy, but it's true. about 22 to 24 every 24 hours. Well, think of it in a different way. Sing 59 or 60, whatever the ultimate number is, dead. That's terrible. No one deserves to die like that. And yet, in the same week that that happened, just do the math. You had 22 people per day, and yet at the end of the week, hundreds of Americans, 3 to 4 times the amount that were killed, died by putting generally a gun in their mouth, blowing their brains out, and not a single article, not an editorial, not a comment, not a demonstration, not a hearing, nothing. But even if there were hearings, the scientists who would come forward from the National Institutes of Mental Health and those who would be selected by the head of the committee would all be pro-Big Pharma, and they would all say that what these people needed was more therapy, but they were all on drugs to begin with. So are you saying that these people needed more of the drug that could have caused them to kill themselves in the first place? There won't be any honest discussion. By the way, this is what you call selective censorship, and it was Galileo who was arrested for spreading supposed lies that the Earth orbits the sun, because everyone knew, of course, back then that the sun orbited the Earth. The Earth didn't move. And today we have no less atrocities. Why didn't we even mention in the media that as terrible as that carnage was and is, the largest mass shooting in U.S. history happened December 20th, 1890, when 297 Sioux Indians were massacred. And these were peaceful people. There was no reason to kill them. And no one was spared, men, women, and children. Why would they do that to these people? Because they could, and because they believed through manifest destiny that they even had a right to do that. Now, that is the danger when you believe that you are motivated by a higher being, that all is forgiven because you're engaged in divine intervention. Why don't you take a look at the facts behind some of the worst mass shootings or mass killings in American history? Just look back. This shouldn't surprise people. What's surprising people is that it looks random, and this was not done by race, you know. But in point of fact, of the people killed in the attack, put it in perspective. A single gunman, supposedly, stormed a Orlando nightclub, killed 49 people, wounding 53 others. Supposedly a single gunman. We don't know for sure, because I'm hearing word from people there might have been other gunmen. 59 killed and counting. And someone called it the deadliest killing spree in American history. Far from it. A little history now. First off, take a look back. And if you're asking when was the last killing of a lot of Caucasians, you're going to have a hard time finding that answer. But if you look at the 19th century of what was happening, you had the Sandy Creek Massacre in 1864. You had 675 soldiers who went to a campsite in Colorado, and they opened fire. They killed 165 Cheyenne and Arapaho tribe members. When the bodies were later counted, more than 50% of those who were killed were women and children. You had a Cheyenne chief. His name was Black Kettle, and he was there to try to stop this by asking with a white flag that they were not armed, they were there to surrender. And he survived the massacre. He was later killed by George Armstrong Custer. You had the Clear Lake Massacre in 1850. And U.S. Cavalry attacked a Pomo Indian tribe. They lived on a little tiny island in what is Lake County, California. 60 men and women and children were killed. And why? Because the soldiers had been told that these Indians allegedly had killed two white settlers. It turns out, based upon an investigation, that there was no proof that they did it, but there was proof that Indians were enslaved and brutalized and starved by these two people. You had the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890. The U.S. Army troops near Wounded Knee Creek in South Dakota killed the Lakota Chief Bigfoot, and more than 150 men, women, and children were killed. But there are many others. Mountain Meadow Massacre in 1857, and 120 people killed. Rock Springs Massacre, 1885. There's a group of white men and women. They rounded up 28 Chinese immigrant laborers, just poor laborers. And why were they killed? Because the whites resented the fact that the Chinese were willing to work at lower wages than what they were given. The Tulsa Race Riots. Now, you don't hear much in our textbooks or anything, but in 1921, what was called the Black Wall Street, there was so much affluency. There were so many people who had educations and cars and businesses. No crime. They burned down the whole area, the Greenwood neighborhood. And at that point, it was the single wealthiest black business district in the United States. And the minimum killed was around 200. Most claim it was 300. I'm doing a special documentary on it, and I'll have all that within a year. Then there was the Elaine Massacre, where black men in Elaine, that's in part of Arkansas, they just wanted to have a meeting and to see about getting more money for their crops. Their crops, of course, at that time was cotton. Well, someone didn't like what happened at that meeting, so a white man started raising hell, and the next thing you know, a riot broke out, and 200 black men were shot and killed because of that. So you see, those are other episodes in American history. If we're going to do a requiem for killings, shouldn't we also pay attention to the history of these and what caused them? We can remember George W. Bush, I certainly do, when he said that we're bringing a crusade, we're engaging a crusade against the terrorist. And he made the mistake of using the word crusade. Maybe it wasn't a mistake. Because what do you imagine a crusade means to the people who have repeatedly have had their country invaded? The crusading armies, like the U.S. military, are based upon cumbersome armament, heavy armor and heavy weapons, against people like the Taliban. We have spy planes, we have drones, we have navies, we have intelligence operatives, we have unlimited budgets, and we're fighting people like the Taliban, who are riding around on donkeys and motorcycles and bicycles, and it's not a giant army, and we spend all this human resources and killed so many people, innocent civilians. It's estimated you kill 20 civilians for every enemy combatant. And so we still didn't change anything. Well, like many crusaders, you end up with people who say, why did you do this to us? Why? What did we do in our culture, in our language, in our towns, under our control? Why did you feel that you could not accept us and you had to change it? So one lesson from the Crusades concerns war as a motivation for unity against an invader. Don't think that all these countries around the world, including in the Middle East, were all friendly, all cooperated, and all were able to coexist peacefully. Rarely is that a case. If you ask the average American, the Crusades are ancient history. They don't know about them. They know the word. They know that some, white knights went off to fight heathens, and that's about the extent of it. And again, the Bush administration was very much crazed, almost as much as they felt were the religious fanatics such as bin Laden, in the rightness of their deeds. The Middle East was heavily divided between the Turks or the Seljuks or the Saracens and various Arab tribes and different caliphs in conflict with each other. Arab successes and the eventual rise of the great Muslim warrior and leader Saladin was due to the need for Arabs to unite to fight the Crusaders. That meant that Iranians, Arabs, Turks, Kurds, Egyptians all became united. That didn't mean that they believed in each other. It didn't mean that they were going to coexist. It meant that in this moment, at this time, we all join together or we all die separately. World War I saw a unique person, T.E. Lawrence. They called him Lawrence of Arabia or Larry of Arabia, and that caused something similar with uniting of the feuding Arab tribes against the Ottoman Turks. In fact, Afghanistan and Iraq invasions gave fuel to the rise of ISIS and other radical terrorist organizations that are multi-ethnic, albeit they're Muslim. So when you think of Muslim, do you realize how many divisions there are within the Muslim overarching religious belief? Many. And while we tend to associate the Crusades with the Christian military expansion into the Holy Lands to take Jerusalem and Palestine away from the Muslims, there are in fact many Crusades, not just one. But they all had something in common. They were all spearheaded by the Church of Rome. Today you would call it Washington, D.C., and the Washington Consensus, the neocons, the globalists, the multinationalists. They're the ones who are, in effect, using the idea of regime change and bringing democracy, peace, and freedom to these countries. And look, we certainly brought peace and freedom and democracy and a higher standard of living and better quality of life to people now living in Libya, right? Wrong. Syria, right? Wrong. Honduras, Paraguay, right? Wrong. I can name 69 countries the United States over the last 100 years intervened in, all in the same way. And always we were looked upon as crusaders. We were doing something for a greater good. It's never been for the greater good. Go back to the Spanish Crusade, 1114, or the Baltic Crusades from 1147 to 1410, or go back to even the English Crusades, 1215, and another one in 1263, or the anti-Turkish Crusades in 1332 to 1571, or the anti-Ottoman Crusades, 1366 to 1699, or the Bohemian Crusades, that would be Bosnia and Serbia, 1420, or the North Africa Crusades, like the Moroccan and Libyan ones, and also parts of Algeria in 1499, 1568. And what are these really? They're all one thing. Forms of Christian globalization, meaning spreading the church's dominance over the nations by military means. And by the way, it was also true in the Old West. It was true in the first expeditions to the new continent, South America, Central America, and North America. In came the Jesuits, in came the missionaries wanting to bring to these heathens, these savages, redemption through religious conversion. And we were doing the same thing in the Crusades. Well, today, the U.S. globalization is the spread of the U.S. military around the planet for the benefit of mega corporate interests, meaning oil, geopolitical strategy, and other resources. And then you spread the religion of free market capitalism. So the Crusades were the first European colonizers of foreign lands. Later there was Britain, into India, and other countries, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Spain, into Africa, South America. Well, today Israel is perceived as a foreign colonizer by Arabs. And yet instead of listening to their grievances to determine objectively which are legitimate and which are not, and what is the best way of resolving some of these issues, we unilaterally sign pledges, literally, figuratively, sign pledges of unbridled support for Israel, no matter what it does, no matter what egregious acts it engages in. And then we have organizations like APEC that will attack you if in any way, shape, or form you suggest that there is any imbalance in the peace efforts between the Palestinians and the Israelis. After the death of Muhammad, Islam expanded via military globalization to spread a religious creed. Muslims reached as far as the gates of Paris. They were defeated there by Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne, and the first Holy Roman Emperor. But I'm going to take you very briefly because I'm seeing my guest is ready, and I want to go over to the guest in a moment. The First Crusade, as we know it, was in 1096, and only lasted 3 years, to 1099. It was also called the People's Crusade. It was just a ragamuffin crusade of commoners, people who thought they could exploit wherever they were, even kids and families. You had your nickel-dime knights under the spell of the friar preacher called Peter the Hermit, completely wiped out, by the way, by the Turks as they crossed the Bosphorus. And right behind the People's Crusade was the Alliance of European Kings Crusade, and they were serious. They brought in their best knights. They brought in strategists. They were well organized. And this is the crusade that captured Jerusalem. And by the way, to show you how civil, mannered, polite, ethical the kings of Europe were and the knights, they slaughtered every single person, man, woman, and child in the city, including Muslims, non-Catholic, Christians, and Jews, and followers of other smaller faiths, and they showed them no preference. You died. And point of fact, the religions of Abraham in the Holy Lands in the Middle East acknowledged their common historical roots, going back to Abraham, and therefore saw each other as brothers and sisters. Europeans held no such view. They were ignorant about the laws of Abraham. Yet in the Middle East, they had that understanding. So then you had a great victory, right, in the fall of Jerusalem. But then you had the Second Crusade in 1147 to 1149. Again, just 2 years. This was the first Catholic Latin holy war against Islam, purely a religious war, started in response to the fall of the city of Edessa in 1144. And by the way, that was a famous city in the history of Jesus and his disciples. So the first of the Crusaders were led by European kings, namely Louis VII of France and Conrad III of Germany, who joined the ranks. And this was a crusade that gave rise to the visionary Sultan Saladin, who united the Middle East. Had it not been for Saladin, one man, the entire Middle East would have fallen, and all the spoils would have gone to the Europeans, and the culture, the Muslim culture, would have been destroyed. Ultimately, this crusade was a failure and became the first great victory for Muslims. And it led to the fall of Jerusalem, which returned to Muslim hands, and the Muslims let, by the way, to show you how equal the Muslims were to the Pope and the religious and court leaders of Europe, when they had complete control of the city, the Muslims let all the captives go, including the Europeans, and conducted no slaughter. They were civil. Did you know that? And this gave rise, then, instead of thank you, to the Third Crusade at the end of the 12th century. It was from 1189 to 1192, again 3 years, and this was called the King's Crusade. Why? Because this is the first time that we really heard about King Richard. He was Richard the Lionheart, and he attempted by European rulers to reconquer the Holy Land from Saladin. And the campaign was largely successful in capturing the important cities of Acre and Jaffa and reversing most of Saladin's conquests, but it failed to capture Jerusalem. And that was really tough. And Saladin and Richard III, however, created a treaty. Muslims would keep Jerusalem, but pilgrims, and including traveling Christians, had free passage to Jerusalem. And therefore, they understood that there was an understanding by both the Muslims and the Christians that there should be a sacredness placed upon Jerusalem, meaning no more battles, no more fighting. If you want to come to this city, you come in peace, and you'll be given open hospitality. And then the failure to capture Jerusalem got everyone antsy, and once again, very shortly thereafter, they caused the Fourth Crusade, 1202 to 1204, a Western Europeans armed expedition called by Pope Innocent III, he was anything but innocent, to reconquer the Muslim-controlled Jerusalem by means of an invasion through Egypt. So instead, a sequence of events culminated in the Crusades sacking the city of Constantinople, which, by the way, was the capital of the Christian-controlled Byzantine Empire. And then you had the Fifth Crusade, 1213 to 1221, and the Sixth Crusade in 1228. Further attempts all failed to recapture Jerusalem and the rest of the Holy Land, and most of the fighting occurred in Egypt and Syria. So what do we know now? We know that the Crusades, including the Saracen and Arab historians, wrote about how completely uncultured the Europeans were. They were barbarians, brutes, uncouth, lecherous. They considered them a step above beasts. The most barbaric act, by the way, which was recorded, was done after the Battle of Merera, when, after the Crusader victory, the troops roasted and ate Muslim babies and children. They were utterly non-hygienic. They were barbaric in their medical practices on the battlefield. Crusaders simply amputated limbs. And the Arabs looked at this as if you are kidding. We're able to perform surgeries and suturing and save limbs and lives. The Crusaders were drunkards who ate unhealthy food, where Islamic medicine and diet was balanced and healthy in comparison. The Crusaders were not only about warfare between the European kingdoms and the Saracens, but also they lacked intercultural exchange. You even see it in the legend of the Holy Grail. So many other stories and encounters happened between the Crusaders, the Christians, and the Arabs. But many historians argue that the interaction between the Western Christian Islamic cultures was ultimately positive in the development of European civilization in the Renaissance. Crusaders were not just armies of troops, but they also had explorers, merchants, doctors, entrepreneurs, scientists. And Crusaders offered some safe passages when they were traveling through the Middle East. And you had scholars, you had philosophers who joined in order to learn the wisdom and science of the Muslims, who were far more advanced. Let me repeat this so we're very clear on this. Before people become too self-righteous about which side, you know, history writes about, you had a culture, a larger overarching culture in the Middle East that was 1,000 years ahead of anything in Europe. I'll tell you what life was like on an upcoming historical perspective if you were living in mini Germany and France and England, and compare that to where you had astronomy, medicine, mathematics, chemistry, alchemy, architecture, urban planning, development, water engineering, and many other things far more advanced. And once the Crusaders and Europeans who came along for the ride settled in Jerusalem and the Crusader kingdoms began to evolve with the Saracens, you never saw Saracens converting to Christianity. You saw a lot of Christians converting to Islam. Remember, Jesus is the second most revered prophet in Islam after Muhammad and recognizes the Spirit of God in the Quran. Isa Ruah Allah. Let me end this segment, since we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left. No society, no one group was all right or all wrong. They had combinations of constructive and destructive elements. It depended upon who was in control. I've said in some of my recent lectures that I've discovered a, a, at least for me, an insight that helps me understand why good people allow bad things to be done in their name, or once a person's in power, how hard it is to remove that person, even when what they're doing goes against the common good. This is as true in Muslim societies as it is in Christian societies. Not every pope, not every person avowing Christian beliefs would look upon someone from another culture, another religion, as a heathen or beneath respect. But I believe that the dominant energy, meaning the single strongest energy, collapses under it all other competing beliefs and ideologies. It's one of those basic rules that you cannot have two energies with equal intensity sharing the same space at the same time. One will always prevail. So a lot goes into determining what prevails. More often than not, it is the use of power, the use of fear, the use of real or perceived threats. So as long as we're told, get along, go along, don't stand out, don't threaten, don't change, don't challenge, you'll be rewarded. And how many times have people compromised on what they knew was a higher truth or higher value just to survive? It was no different at that time as well. So look at the Muslim cultures at that time in the Middle East. Before there were great libraries in Europe, you had great libraries and colleges, and they were ones that were open. They taught world cultures from Europe to China to India. They acknowledged the wisdom that was found in all cultures and civilizations, completely unlike medieval Europe that was based upon pure superstition. The Arab agricultural revolution was the most unique in the world. Irrigation technology in the deserts to support large populations. They were the first to create processes such as sublimation and reduction and distillation in chemistry, originally an alchemical process. They designed the first water clock in Toledo, the development of trigonometry and astrological calculations of fixed stars and moving planets. They also used algebra, and they were the first to use algebra as a recreational and educational activity, which was founded by an 8th century intellect, Al-Khwarizmiyya. They also invented the decimal fractions. They were the first to have accurate determinations of the solar year done in 860. They had highly advanced botanical sciences and inquiries into the natural world, giving rise to a systematic pharmacology that spread through the Islamic world, including all phases of plant growth. In fact, there's a very famous 6-volume encyclopedia on the medicinal use of plants from the 11th century, from Dinawaris. They also were highly advanced in medical systems, with many volumes of treaties that took the best of world medical practices from Greece, from Rome, from China, and India, and Persia. They were first to study toxicology and identify why certain metals, such as copper and arsenic and mercury, were poisonous, and that was in the 10th century. They had a complete and separate discipline in surgery. They also understood hygiene, the science of optics, and the treaties on eye care and correction of vision based on laws of fraction. We call it Snell's Law. And that was in the 800s. And it didn't get into the West until the 17th century. This was also based upon Muslims' fascination and studies of the phenomenon of light and how light. They were the first to create eye improvement lenses and agricultural volumes for good agronomics practices for caring for plants and vegetables and herbs and trees and shrubs, including grafting and treating plant diseases naturally. They were very advanced in cartography and map making, and a world map created in 1150 describing all the different climates and resources of the known world. In fact, the first map of the new world was in 1513. And physics was a big deal for them, found on laws of the kinematics and dynamic motion in the 6th century based upon Aristotle's work, and much of the mathematics of motion were studied by Muslims, which further advanced what Greeks had discovered, including Abaja's research into force in the 12th century way before Newton's third law of motion. Now, I'm out of time. I could go on. I just want you to know that there's a whole lot that we should appreciate for what the great thinkers of that time had to share with us. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.